the name is very much in dispute. I would say that East Turkestan is a sensitive term. It's used by a number of Uyghurs, many of them in exile, because the term is banned in China itself. In China, the region is known as the Xinjiang Uyghur Autonomous Region.
Tell us about this region prior to 1949.
So prior to 1949, the region was really contested by a number of interested parties. From 1933 to 1934, there was an independent republic based in Kashgar that was established by the Uyghurs. A second republic that then was established in 1944 to 49. In 1949, the People's Liberation Army entered Xinjiang, and at that point, communist administration began in the region. So prior to 49, it was quite chaotic, a number of warring parties, warlords and the like. Then after 49, the communists consolidated stability in the region.
What was behind the chaos?
Well, I would say that it was a time when the Chinese Republicans were in charge, and they had a number of issues in eastern China with the Kuomintang, had issues with the communists. A civil war was in place in the east, so the west really was off their agenda, and fiefdoms were established among local warlords in the area.
A lucrative region. It sat right along the Silk Road, bridged mainland China to Arabic, Persian, European cultures.
Yes, it certainly is a lucrative region. On the one hand, it has quite substantial oil reserves, 2.5 billion tons, and also natural gas, up to 700 billion cubic meters. Also, it acts as a conduit to the markets of Central Asia, South Asia too. So the Chinese government uses the region to access the natural resources in Central Asia through Xinjiang.
And from your perspective, Dr. Zajewski, what is happening there right now? How is China treating this region?
There are a number of restrictions in place, and they focus on a number of aspects of Uyghur life. Freedom of expression is curbed, religious expression too, and also the language as well has also been targeted, in that now Uyghur children only learn Mandarin at school. So there is a number of ways in which the Chinese government policies have restricted life among Uyghurs. However, the Chinese government view it as a development issue, bringing Uyghurs into what they believe the 21st century and their version of modernity and development. The Uyghurs themselves feel like they haven't had much say in what that should look like.
Nuclear testing going on there as well, yes?
That ceased in the mid-90s, oh. And I think I was there for one of the last ones. So the skies darkened, and somebody told me it was a sandstorm, and then other people said it was certainly not a sandstorm. But there were, I believe, over 40 tests, atmospheric and also underground. As a result, there have been some health issues in the area.
And the PLA houses Chinese soldiers a lot there? That's what I've read. I don't know if that's...
They do, yeah. There has been a spike in the number of People's Liberation Army troops in the region, especially since security has now become a priority in the area. There's also another very interesting aspect to a sort of paramilitary organization called the Bingtuan, which is established in Xinjiang, and it was established for consolidation of the state in the region, it being very far away from Beijing. And those people who work on the Bingtuan are also sometimes called in when security issues are a priority.
From what I'm hearing from you, just this basic information, I can't help but to draw a comparison to Tibet. Is that a reasonable comparison?
Absolutely. And many Uyghurs like to say that they're the Tibetans that you've never heard of.
Tell us about the people themselves. They're a Muslim people, is that correct?
That's correct.
More on the fundamentalist side or more of a secular strain, I guess?
There are a range of people practicing Islam among the Uyghurs. In general, it's a moderate version of Islam, and I think that goes for the Central Asian region in general. The Islam is Sufi-infused, but also it has some traces of pre-Islamic traditions too. So I would characterize it as a moderate version of Islam.
When you say Sufi-infused, what does that mean?
It means that there's worship of saints and also Many Uyghurs go to pilgrimage sites and leave tokens there, asking for saints to grant wishes. But also there's a mystical strain to their religion too. On one occasion in Kashgar when I was there, there were in front of the mosque on one of the festival days, many of the Uyghurs spin themselves into a trance in order to become closer to God. I remember my first visit to Xinjiang. I guess I termed it as assault by hospitality. Wherever I went, I was offered food and the people very, very generous, but also with a lot of intellectual capacity and deep thinkers about their condition and looking for ways to improve that in the future.
Uyghurs are a relatively new player when it comes to Westerners, I think. That's my assumption. Mm-hmm. Americans. And when we do hear about them in the American news media, it's always in relation to, again, my perspective, some form of violence. Mm. A knife attack in a faraway rail station. A fatal car attack in Tiananmen Square. Theories of Uyghur involvement in Flight 370's disappearance. I guess, number one, is my characterization correct? And what do you think of Western news coverage of the Uyghurs?
It's unfortunate that the focus has been on violent incidents. Now, I cannot deny that there have been violent incidents. Last year, from my own research, just in 2013 alone, 219 people were killed in 25 separate incidents in Xinjiang alone. So, yes, there has been a spike in violence, but that is not the entire story. There is a story of peaceful dissent. There is a story of people also trying to negotiate an identity for themselves in the 21st century. So my characterization would be, of course, that the media certainly would like to focus on those particular violent incidents because they are headline grabbing in many ways, whilst the slow progression of human rights advocacy, for example, is certainly something that doesn't capture the eye easily.
You said that many are trying to negotiate an identity for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Negotiate what and how?
Well, because the Chinese state has tried to influence the Uyghurs to come join modern China, and in many ways that has been through asking young Uyghurs to learn Chinese as their main medium, the language that they should speak in everyday life. So I think that those Uyghurs are trying to balance up their Uyghurness and then this new part of this new identity that's being offered by the Chinese state. So a lot of them are trying to fuse the two and see how that will work for them in the future. It's a careful balancing act. On the one hand, they do need Mandarin skills in order to be successful in the job market, but they also don't want to lose their cultural identity at the same time. So at the moment, there's an interesting negotiation between many young Uyghurs about how to move forward with those two identities.
Odds are against them. They're so outnumbered.
Indeed. However, I would add that there's hope. I think that many Uyghurs strongly identify as Uyghurs. It's a way to show separateness from Han Chinese, for example. And also, it's something that is a pride that is handed down from generation to generation. A recent survey, for example, stated that 90% of Uyghurs were proud to be Uyghurs as compared to perhaps 66% of Han Chinese. And that shows me that there's strength for the future.
Chinese President Xi Jinping is earning a reputation, I think, as a man of – he's a tough guy. How would you characterize his treatment of that region, that disputed autonomous region?
We were very hopeful at first when Xi Jinping was to assume the presidency. He talked about reform. However, some of those promises have not been kept. Specifically, earlier this year, he discussed how he would de-emphasize development policies in Xinjiang and emphasize security in the region. And that meant a crackdown not just on violent dissenters, but peaceful dissenters too. So that's of concern.
And Vladimir Putin?
Vladimir Putin, that's a great question, because I think that what he is up to in the Ukraine is something that the Chinese are keeping an eye on, because it's about sovereignty issues, and China is extraordinarily sensitive about sovereignty regarding Tibet, Xinjiang, Mongolia, Taiwan, and also the South China Sea too. Mm. So at this point, it's a wait and see game for the Chinese.
Mm. Also joining us today is Dr. Mehrdad Kia, director of the University of Montana Central and Southwest Asian Study Center. Nice to see you again. Tell us about the conference underway that brought Dr. Sijevsky to us.
Thank you, Ed. This is, as you know, the 12th annual Central and Southwest Asia Conference. We are extremely happy that we have managed to hold this conference with a large number of scholars, analysts, diplomats, writers, journalists coming to University of Montana for the last 12 years. This year, we are very excited. We have an outstanding speaker who will speak about China, Western China, and Chinese policy in a very critical region of the world, which is only coming to the attention of the American public recently. But this has been a historical area of conflict, Central Asia and next to it, Western China. But we also have an excellent presentation tomorrow night on the question of the Arab Spring, the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, with Dr. Shukri Abed, who comes directly from Jerusalem. And then during 3 days, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, we have a number of wonderful panels, and panelists are coming from all over. It might be of some interest that tomorrow we will have a presentation by a Uyghur artist, in fact, Nejat Hushur, who comes from Xinjiang, and he will talk about arts and cultures of the Uyghur people.
I don't mean to spring this on you. Forgive me if it's a surprise. You mentioned the Arab Spring. Uh-huh. What's your take on it right now? The Arab Fall, the Arab Winter?
You know that I think when we last talked, I mentioned that it was quite rainy and cold in the Arab world, and the results have not been the Jeffersonian democracy that some had predicted. I think with the sole exception of Tunisia, you may conclude that the Arab Spring has moved toward a very cold winter. And the situation in Egypt with the rise of a new military dictator, the Syrian civil war ongoing and becoming even more violent, the unsettling situation in Iraq itself, all of this makes you very pessimistic. But, you know, history moves forward. The Arab people showed that there is at least an educated, moderate, middle class in the Arab world, as you saw in the case of Tunisia and Egypt and earlier in Syria, who are demanding democracy, human rights, a more transparent and less corrupt government. And those folks are still around. So it is not over. As a country, we have gone through some major struggles to get where we are. And I think the Arab world has awakened to the need for change. But how this change will come about will be very interesting to see.
Henrik, you're nodding your head in agreement.
Absolutely. Yes, I think that this is something that seems very critical to China, too, and how democratic reforms will play out in the future.
The 12th Annual Central and Southwest Asia Conference at the University of Montana. Professor Kia, how can people find out more? Is there a clearinghouse of information?
Yes, we are on the main UM website, so the schedule is there, as well as, of course, on Central Southwest Asian Studies Center website, cswa.umt.edu. And we look forward to having everyone, and it's open to public and it's free.
And Henrik Sijevsky, you are not new to Missoula, as it turns out.
Absolutely, that's right. I got married here. My wife grew up in Missoula, and this University of Montana is her alma mater. So I'm very, very happy to be back.
Excellent to have you here. It is a very small world, as we were saying earlier. Thank you both for coming in. It was great talking.
Thank you very much, Ed.